happening now. We would like to welcome our viewers from across North America and around the world. This is the EdTech Situation Room, episode 320 for February the 21st, 2024. My name is Wes Fryer, and I'm coming to you from Matthews, North Carolina, where I am a middle school media literacy and STEM teacher. And I'm being joined, as always, from Dr. Neifer, who appears to possibly be in his home gym and greenhouse tonight. How are you, Jason?
Well, good evening, Dr. Fryer. I'm doing well, and it's true. I have relocated virtually to some kind of home theater gym, although that kind of looks like those are beanbags and a massive-sized theater screen, so I have that going for me. And I like a good industrial layout to an office as well. But hey, good evening from Missoula, Montana. I'm the executive director of Montana Digital Academy, which is Montana State Virtual School, located in the beautiful University of Montana campus, located right here in Missoula, Montana. And I apologize for, was it 2 weeks away, 3 weeks away? I got the coves one more time. So it's my second round through. Luckily, it was an extremely light course in comparison to my first time through the battle. And then last week I was at the wonderful NCC conference where I got to see all my Pacific Northwest and really nationwide ed tech friends. Still remains, one of my favorite events every year. So it's a real honor to be back in Seattle, for that conference. That's the first time we were in Seattle proper since COVID. So it was, 4 years ago in March when, I think I've told the story a couple of times on the podcast that during the middle of the conference, they were starting to shut Seattle down. And I walked across the street from the convention center, rented a car from Hertz, loaded up my luggage, and drove home to Missoula, Montana. So that will be a memory that will stick with me for quite some time. But I don't think this is about COVID. I don't think this is even about weather or towns. Wes, what are we doing here?
Well, we are here to gather and discuss the tech news, and we're going to try to pass that through the educational prism. So tonight's topics, as always, include a number of AI articles, along with some experiments and new tools and a framework, I guess, social media, media literacy, security and privacy, hardware, and then our Geeks of the Week. But I do need to ask some weather questions. So what is going on in Missoula? Have you all had any odd weather? It seems like you've had some pretty big fluctuations this winter. Is that an accurate observation?
First of all, the snowpack here is the lowest on record. And that's terrifying because, first of all, we're in the middle of a drought anyways. And agriculture is so important to our economy. And, you know, because we grow food, too, it's a concern to everyone. But also, as we've talked about in the past, that when Montana doesn't have a really great winter, it dramatically increases the chance of a pretty significant wildfires. And so I do think this is part of, you know, the changing climate era. None of this is all that big of a surprise, because I think there's been estimations of this kind of impact for decades now. But yeah, so it's rained more here. It's rained here more than it snowed, which, you know, is more central Washington-y, maybe central Oregon-y than it is Montana. There are other towns that are doing a little better in Montana. But we had a 65 degree a day last month, which is wild for this time of year. And, yeah. So, and I'm going to be in Austin next week for the Digital Learning Annual Conference. And I am excited to see that the weather there, will be in the mid 70s, cause I am looking forward to some springy weather. But yeah, I hope that winter kind of gets its act together and starts dumping snow on us with reckless abandon.
Oh man, I hope so too. I'm looking forward in a couple weeks, right before our spring break, to going back up to Raleigh to the NC Ties conference, and I'm going to be able to share a few sessions this year. So I feel like I've come out of presentation hibernation. I just haven't been doing a lot for a while, so I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah, and I had an opportunity to give 4 presentations in Seattle, and it's just something I like doing. So it's
not to put you on the spot, but did you do anything new? Because this is sort of, isn't this the time you kind of reinvent your conference presentations for the year?
Yeah, I do. I try to break them out at NCCE. Well, one of them that I did that was new, that it was a kind of a different concept, and the people that showed up, I think, liked it. I also needed to move the session because I was actually on a virtual meeting with my good friends in the Wisconsin eSchool Network to talk about AI with them. But it was called Show Us Your Bag. And the point I was making, and I kind of, as I typically do in my presentations, I kind of start off with a philosophical point before we jump into the context of the presentation. But my point was that in all this era of kind of hand-wringing about tech, we also should be embracing the nerd joy that still very much exists. And one of the things I love doing is checking out how people store and carry around their tech. And I particularly love, you know, and again, I'm next level nerd on this stuff. I had a good friend in another state virtual school a couple years ago saying, God, you're snobby about the most bizarre things. It's true that I am snobby about the most bizarre things, but, you know, I carry around an extremely well curated, case with cables in it. And, I have tech bags that have been a slow evolutionary process, over the last 20 years. And so about 15 people in the room, it was great. People shared things. There was a kind of another gearhead in there that was a CTE teacher from Washington, and he was carrying around some really cool stuff. And he's the guy that pulls out his Leatherman. But like he pulls it out like he uses it pretty frequently, right? That's how you know those particular pieces. But yes, that was a new session that I'd like to try again. We'll see. And then, in addition to, I refurbished a session that I had started off 2 months ago here in Montana. And it's called What Can AI Do For You? And it's kind of a lab of sorts where I try to introduce, you know, there's really basic prompting and then there's multi-shot prompting, which I think is the better prompting, in my opinion.
Multi-shot meaning, what is that?
I mean that you just don't accept the first answer, that you kind of treat prompting as an evolutionary process. So your first result, unless it's really great, you should always give it additional parameters to work through. And that's been a very successful strategy for me. And then I also showed off, these are demos that are silly, but they're really effective. You know, you can have ChatGPT, Copilot, Claude write multiple choice questions for you, if you like. But as it turns out, one of the things that is interesting about that is that you can very much impact your experience with those large language models if you give it something in addition to just, write multiple choice questions. So my kind of quick and dirty demo is I go out to Google and I look for a PDF that's how to write multiple choice questions. And there are literally dozens and dozens of PDFs to do that. But the one that's in the top five always is there's a 70 page PDF from Kansas State, the education department at Kansas State, that was written like in 2001, but it goes into extremely painful detail about how to write excellent multiple choice questions. And so if you provide that as training data, then you're going to get much better multiple choice questions than if you do nothing at all. And what I like to do is actually tell ChatGPT or its cousins, tell me why this follows the guidance. And then it will walk you through, you know, what about the guidance it used to write this question and why.
Wow.
And that's where that's kind of where we're organizationally MTDA is at right now. Like I think I mentioned that I am going to use AI tools to help rewrite a world geography curriculum. It's not something that we're able to really get from vendors, and I really would like to use these tools in a very advanced way. And one of the ways that we're doing this in kind of a nuanced way is that we are building a huge document of training data. So it's the best practices in universal design for learning. It's the best practice for students need multiple representations of content. It's the best practice for students that are advanced. They're a best practice for students that have learning disabilities that need to be accounted for. And so we're going to see if by putting all the best data in one document in order to kind of ping off of as we're writing these courses and brainstorming what to do in the courses, if it can help us with that incredibly balanced issue of making something that's accessible to students but meet all their varied and diverse needs. And so we're real excited about it. I've got about a 60-page document right now that we're going to hone down to a good 40 pages. I've read, you know, every book there is to read now on things like, you know, best practices for designing a course from scratch. I've written online courses before from scratch, but those were mostly gut-based, and that works for me. But you can't develop a process when you're gut-basing it, right? So I have a wonderful colleague of mine named Caitlin, who's been with our staff for a couple of years. It's also really interested in these topics. And so we're working together on a sustainable process to figure out a way to write great stuff utilizing a friendly voice that we train it on. So
I hope you'll maybe share your bibliography as you're creating those best practices, because I think one of the things with the custom GPTs that is helpful if people are willing to share, you know, is what they put in terms of the instructions and the training materials and things like that. I know that I have found ChatGPT and even the custom GPTs to really be fairly frustrating in the last couple of weeks, in part because some of the things I've wanted to write about and generate images about relate to political polarization, my online course I'm teaching about teaching the conspiracies, and even when I'm asking for like a Norman Rockwell style 50s city council school board meeting where everyone's listening to each other and they're just paying attention, they're like, no, I'm not going to touch that. And it's like, are you kidding me? But I've also noticed that it seems to not want to do as much work. Now, sometimes I'm trying to get it to code, but if I break it into small pieces and say, well, you do this and it'll do that and then do this. And, you know, it is really just fascinating to be literally interacting with this artificial intelligence. And so I think that, you know, as you create this course and you have other ones that you can use as models, it is really remarkable how well it can match what you have done before. And I was mentioning before we went live on the show that the custom GPT that I have built to, you know, take the transcript of our shows, give a summary, give five different three-word show title options, and then base the writing off of previous human-written, you know, summaries, it's actually getting better, and I'm really not doing anything, and that's the model itself improving. It's crazy. It's really crazy. So I think that's super exciting work that you all are doing, and really that, hey, that sounds like some good journal articles for you to put out there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to point out one other thing that I've been working on, and maybe part of our show should just be Jason and Wes talking about AI. But here's something that I find to be really interesting. As is, if you ask one of these large language models to write in a more student-friendly way, and this is particular to history stuff, right? So I've given it an outline of what I want covered, and maybe I've trained it on an open source college textbook or something, but what tends to happen is that it adds, like when I ask it to write in a narrative way, which is, you know, how I think history should be taught. History is a grand story, so it should be a narrative. And I kind of want to be like, write like I do, right? And again, you know, one could argue, I think quite legitimately, that Jason, maybe you should just write the thing yourself. There's a point to be made there, but I have honed back finally something that's giving me consistently the warm writing that I'm looking for when I'm generating text. And it's long, but I based it off of training on several emails that I've written in the last 10 years that I know were good emails, right? Come off as very personable. And it's a huge paragraph, but it's, please use my style of writing, which can be described as informative, personable, and reassuring, with a touch of professional yet friendly educator. The voice is one that speaks with authority and knowledge, but also a warm and approachable tone that makes it feel like you're having a conversation with a trusted mentor. It's a voice that's always ready to help, to guide, to reassure. When writing, remember to keep your language clear and straightforward, but don't shy away from showing a bit of personality. And then it goes on for another paragraph. And not only do I like this because, oh, what? Is that how I write emails? Oh, my God. But I also, I mean, you have to find something that consistently gets the outputs that you're looking for. And this is what's worked for me. When I train on that and then ask it to write, you know, paragraphs on X, Y, and Z, it does a pretty good job at that. And so that's something that I, again, it bizarre, right? How this works, because it is so human, in that, you know, it even changing a couple words of that will change the tone of the output. But I have been very interested in kind of playing around how that works.
Oh man, that is fantastic. Well, just before our show, I was on the Wednesday night for the Media Ed Institute, which is the 6-week live as well as asynchronous or anytime learning experience out of the Media Education Lab. And that's where I'm teaching the asynchronous course, teaching the conspiracies. Well, Wednesdays, we have our live keynotes and about 2 hours of interaction. And I was thinking that he had presented for K-12 online, but I don't know if you're familiar with Troy Hicks. He is a writing professor and is just absolutely amazing. He's got a new book coming out, and he's really big on digital writing and digital authorship. And so the three roles for AI that he and his writing partner have identified is, number one, thinking partner, number two, research assistant, and number three, co-writer. I think those are really, really good roles to think about. Perhaps the co-writer is a little controversial, but I could segue us to an article if we would like.
Although, well, it is that.
Okay. Well, this is actually from Troy's keynote that he shared tonight, and this is an op-ed that came from CNN. Which, by the way, if you'd like to go to edtechsr.com/links, you can get a link, and we're going to drop these into our chats for YouTube Live as well as Facebook Live. The op-ed from September 16th, 2023 is titled High School Senior, Why Aren't More Teachers Embracing AI? And Jason, I think you'll love the author's perspective. It is Sidhai Danda, who is a high school student from Massachusetts. And basically, he's making the case that teachers need to be embracing AI as a student, to your point about the level at which it can write. He talked about I think it was a computer science course that he was taking, and he asked it, he was having trouble with these concepts, to write it so an elementary student could understand it. And it presented a great metaphor, and it was really a big aha for him. And, you know, he acknowledges, you know, the criticisms and fears that people have about, you know, plagiarism. But he says there are very powerful and legitimate uses for AI, thinking about kind of like what Troy was talking about as a thinking partner, being able to brainstorm, being able to, you know, get feedback on your writing. And so there's some good links in the article, but I thought that was outstanding. And the fact that it's from a high school student, that also, I think, you know, should resonate or land a little bit, perhaps more strongly with teachers, because yes, we've got these students sitting in our rooms, and I know there's folks that, you know, of course, plagiarism existed before AI, right? I mean, if you hadn't been aware of essay writing services, I don't know where your head has been, probably in the sand, because there's been all these different services and things. But these tools and the ways in which we can have these, you know, what I would consider to be superpowers, or just a super assistant, right? This amazing partner that we have to be able to take our writing, give us a lens to, you know, possibly see ways that it can improve it, or just go ahead and co-write with us. You know, I was telling my wife, it's when my mother was alive, she really loved to edit my things. And I wouldn't, like, I would send her everything, but, you know, I would. I'd get feedback from her. And I don't think it was cheating. I think it was fine. Our daughter's at the Air Force Academy, so, you know, their honor code is the most stringent honor code of any academic institution I've ever heard of, because it has a toleration clause where you can get actually kicked out of the institution if you are aware of others violating the code and you tolerate that and don't report it. But, you know, they have, you know, very strong guidelines that are instructor by instructor, you know, dependent. So they vary. But, you know, where did you get your help? Did you get resources? You know, so, I mean, I've been cited in several papers. I talked to my dad about this, you know, but anyway, excellent article. And I don't know if you've seen anything else kind of like that, where it's a student's perspective on AI kind of lamenting the slow uptake of some schools and some teachers of, you know, taking a look at the possibilities here.
Yeah, and I'm just going to say this too. One of the things that I've run into in the last couple of days that I think is something we need to be thinking about is that I know some teachers that are doing interesting things in this space for sure, right? Like, there's a dozen of them that I'm on fairly regular connection with. I haven't heard of schools or districts that are anywhere past the initial exploration phase. And one of the reasons why I know that is I was talking to a district, it happens to be my alma mater district. I taught there briefly in the early 2000s, and I went to, you know, K-12 school there, and they have a task force working on AI, and they're being extremely proactive. I'm very proud of them. In fact, it was one of the first presentations I gave in the state of Montana on AI was to their administrators last year. So they're being really, really proactive about this issue and this content. But, you know, they asked me a question. I attended one of their meetings the other day virtually, and they asked, you know, are there other districts we can look at that you feel like are doing a really great job with this? And unfortunately, my answer is no. I know a lot of administrators that are being really thoughtful and proactive about this. I know a lot of individual teachers that are. When it comes to bigger kind of units here, like schools, districts, even states, I don't know a lot of that. So I did put a call out over LinkedIn the other day, asking for stories. I'd like to maybe write up some of these stories. Interestingly enough, most people that connected with me were sharing kind of, you know, their best practices about AI. And that's great. I like that sharing component. And I still think the EdTech community is one of the best sharing communities out there. But the problem is that I think that we're getting to a point where there is a lot of good professional development available, right? A lot of people are doing really interesting things. A couple of folks in Montana are. I know that our staff is doing some pretty interesting stuff. That's all, you know, super obvious, but that good work is going on here, right? But when it comes to systems that are actually, you know, grabbing the bulls by the horn here and heading in, you know, and it's not, and it, as I talk about when I speak about AI often, is that I understand why people haven't kept a close eye on this, both because of the speed of the evolution, but more importantly, it's just a time where there's so much to focus on in education right now, right? Like there's so much good news / bad news that I think it would be enormously tough, you know, to keep a full eye on this. But if you are a listener and have a story about a school department, even if you're part of a college that's doing something interesting, please get in touch with me because I would love to hear more about that. And more importantly, I want to share your work with others.
Absolutely. All right. Well, where else would you like to go? I started us off with an AI article, but we still definitely don't have to stay there. So where would you like to do next?
Well, let's see. Actually, I want to hear you talk about the conspiracy theories involving Taylor Swift and the Super Bowl, because I have some here.
Okay. Let's see. So we've got that under, yeah, this is an NPR article from February 1st. I put this under the media literacy link. In the class that I'm teaching now for the Media Ed Institute, I'm teaching the conspiracy theories. The main part of that curriculum is sharing what I've done with students over really the past, I guess it's 5 years, where we have introduced the SIFT web literacy framework in the context of the moon landing hoax conspiracy theory that we never landed on the moon. And so my plan was to talk a little bit in the fifth week about contemporary conspiracy theories. Well, we have a number of folks participating in the course who are not teaching students currently or who are teaching adults and in like a library, public library setting. And so, you know, contemporary conspiracy theories are, you know, important and relevant. And so I moved that up and we did that in I think week three. So this article from NPR titled "Why Conspiracy Theories About Taylor Swift and the Super Bowl Are Spreading," you know, talks about some of the reasons why these are popular, but it also, you know, some of this has to do with attention economy. Whenever you get somebody who has such a high profile, I mean, it seems like everyone was almost more freaked out about Taylor Swift, you know, being at the Super Bowl and her relationship with Travis Case and all this than maybe the Super Bowl itself. But, some of this is rooted in some conspiracy theory that goes back to Pizzagate. It goes back to QAnon. You know, this idea that Taylor is it's a psyop and the government is behind this. You don't know how much of this is also people who are, you know, looking for attention and trying to get clicks and likes. But I mean, when you look, if you do the research on, you know, Pizzagate and, you know, things that are spread on some different right-wing internet sites and social media sites, there's a whole lot of conspiracy theories that these groups seem to love to marinate in. And so part of what is also highlighted in this article is the non-consensual deepfake pornography, which took place and was spread on Twitter. I just don't call it X anymore. It was Twitter to me. It died basically for me when Musk took it over. So whatever. This thing that is continuing that the site formerly known as Twitter, you know, was one of several sites that spread this kind of again, non-consensual deepfake pornography. So there's some real dark sides to all of this. And I think that it is important for us to recognize conspiracies have been around forever. There are a lot of reasons for them, reasons that they are popular, but there's also unique reasons why social media not only is sort of uniquely designed, whether that was with intention or not, for polarization and for a lack of opportunities to have some great dialogue and listen to each other and develop empathy. Like, those things are really not baked into the platforms. And this kind of potentially viral content, which is very extremist, tends to be amplified way beyond what most people would probably think is healthy for either individuals or for society. And so there were a number of articles that we had shared. And if you want to go to Google News and put in Taylor Swift Super Bowl conspiracy, I'm sure there's a bunch of additional ones that you can read as well.
Well, and of course, the most concerning thing about that is that, like, how far is our culture kind of broken when it comes to information, right? In a world where this particular conspiracy theory seems to have so many believers and those that are spreading this information. And I also note for the record that, you know, that this would essentially involve a conspiracy of epic proportions, right? And I'm not even talking about the United States government. That itself is bad enough. You're also involving one of the biggest private, you know, enterprises on earth, which is the National Football League, right? And, you know, I also want to note for the record that if it ever became if it was true that the National Football League was rigging the Super Bowl for a political purpose, it would be tragically terrible for a lot of people that have a lot of financial vested interest in that particular enterprise, not the least of which are the businesses that advertise with the National Football League. And I do understand why the NFL is interested in talking about the Taylor Swift story, because I do think it brings a lot of potential new fans to the enterprise, right? But yeah, I wish I could understand any of this stuff, but it just seems so far from what is possibly provable that it's pretty striking.
I'll talk a little bit. Maybe I haven't been able to share a Geek of the Week for so long. I want to overshare, but one of my Geeks of the Week is really a great discussion about maybe the efforts right now with the Fediverse to re-architect social sharing platforms and to perhaps get the social sharing tools that will serve us well as individuals and as a community versus what we have now that serve, you know, corporations and folks that want to advertise and arguably people that want to amplify really extremist content and polarize, you know, the country. There are folks that want to do that and are probably very happy with the status quo. So good conversations. And I would just give a shout out. I'll put a link in here. But if you're interested in any of that stuff, since 2019, I've been doing a media literacy inquiry project called Conspiracies and Culture Wars that started at the Summer Institute in Media Literacy, or in Digital Literacy is what it was called then. I'll put a link to that. You can go to medialiteracy.westfriar.com, and then you can find that. And there's actually a private Facebook group, which I maintain now, that, you know, I'm not that I'm, well, some of this content is very polarizing. And let's just say I feel safer, you know, sharing some of that within a private Facebook group than I'd even do saying on the show, because all of our words are transcribed. All of this is archived on the web. And you know, there is a real dark side to this stuff that, you know, I think we would ignore at our peril as a society and as a government.
Yep, absolutely.
All right, what next? Or do you mean what
you're doing? Let's see here. This one is just funny to me. So if we've broadcasted since the Vision Pro was released, right?
Yeah, we've talked about it a little bit, but not that much.
I'm going to be in Austin next week. I'm going to see, it's going to be hard to find a time that I can fit in. I would like to go in and do the demo, because I think that would be super interesting. I know, my colleague and buddy Mike is also interested in doing that as well. But when I first saw the story out and the video that came with it, I did, giggle pretty hard. Mark Zuckerberg, says that the Quest 3 is a better product, period, than the Vision Pro. And he produced a video where he was pretty dismissive, and also makes this broad claim that not even at the price point, but the product in general is better, period. And I don't know, because to be honest, I've only put on a VR headset maybe three times in my life. And, one of them was a demo, that did last for, 30 minutes, that was, you know, pretty good. I think it was a couple years back at ISTE, if I remember correctly. And then there was also, a couple of other times where I put one on for 3 minutes, sort of a deal. But I do find it entertaining, because I do believe that even if Mr. Zuckerberg is right, that the Quest is a better product, you know, he's comparing, you know, 7-8 years of development versus, you know, version one of the Apple product. And for me, this product only makes sense for me if it works inside of an ecosystem, because and I'm convinced the reason why Apple has a lot of magic in the world is because my watch, my tablet, my laptop, my desktop, my TV device, my watch, everything that is Apple-ized, works together seamlessly. And if that's as easy as putting a headset on, and you may have seen the demo, Wes, about, that you can, just stare at your screen and your laptop and then pull your head up, and then the laptop outputs to the Vision Pro so that you can interact with the screen. I'm not going to pay $3,500 for that, and that's not going to be the price of that, you know, 5 years from now. Maybe $3,500, you know, with inflation in place, but it's going to be a better consumer facing product at some point. I think it took the watch a while to get to that point, but it is interesting to listen to Mr. Zuckerberg, you know, very defensively defend his product.
Well, let's segue to Sora and talk about where we're headed with the holodeck. This was my Wonderlink today for my, both coding kids and then my, media literacy or my computer app students. So this last week, OpenAI announced Sora. And so I've got a link there to their official page, which is just openai.com/Sora. Have you taken a look at those videos yet, by the way?
I have. Wait, okay. And they're stunning.
Yeah, they are. And so the video that I would recommend everyone check out, is what, about 10 minutes long. Is it Marquez Brownlee? Yeah. Do you know how to say his first name?
Marquez.
Okay. It's called, oh my gosh. Yeah. He's got 18 and a half million subscribers. AI generated videos just changed forever is the title of it. And so he's reflecting on this. And then I've also got a link I'll drop in to, OpenAI's actual video, which doesn't have audio. But again, this is text to video, just, you know, invented out of the ether. So there's not any kind of, you know, uploaded image that says here, make this better or something. It's just text that creates it. And it's a 10.5 minute video and it includes the prompts. So with my students, we went ahead and watched Marquise Brownlee's video, or I think we watched about half of it. Let him talk and then put up the OpenAI version, which has even more examples. And this is how I want to segue to the Quest 3 that Zuckerberg is you know, peddling. And then, you know, Apple's, as you say, initial entry into this VR world and this AR world. And I really think that the Star Trek holodeck is going to be here. It's going to be here very soon. I think that a version of it could already be in existence, but wisely, OpenAI, I think, is going to delay the public release of this until after the US elections in November of 2024. The thing is, and this is what Marquise says in his video, he has a year ago, I guess, there was some AI video of Will Smith eating spaghetti. And it just looks really silly. It looks very cartoonish. But when you realize that was cutting edge state of the art a year ago, and then these examples that you're seeing out of OpenAI are really, really incredible. And they aren't the kind of things that most people can just immediately look at and say, oh, yeah, that's faked or whatever. That's artificial. And as he points out, I mean, when you know you're going to be watching an AI created video, you're already primed to be looking for weird hands or strange artifacts or whatever. But the fact is, we are all inundated with video constantly online and offline too. And we are simply not equipped or ready to handle what is basically imminent, and that is going to be an onslaught of mis and disinformation. But on the good side, I think we're going to have some phenomenal tools and experiences for virtually immersing ourselves in almost any kind of environment. And unlike a quote virtual field trip or something that's going to be, you know, curated and the experience is all, you know, scripted and probably pretty well defined, or even a video game. If you think about an immersive video game and so many different pathways and choices, think about it being completely unbounded, because generative AI tools are going to be able to create all kinds of interactions. I mean, I think we're going to see video games soon, just like we are creating training models, Jason, with Google LM and with the custom GPTs in ChatGPT-4. I think that you're going to be able to do that as a game designer and a world designer, and you're going to be able to put in as much creative input as you want, and then you're going to release this thing and people are going to be able to use it for, you know, entertainment, for education, for all kinds of things. And I think that the tool we're going to use to experience and explore that is exactly what, you know, Mark Zuckerberg was strapping to his head. It's going to be cheaper. It's going to be lighter. But when we wed that kind of VR and AR technology to the generative AI video capabilities that we have seen out of OpenAI and Sora this week, then it's whoosh, suddenly the holodeck of Star Trek is here.
Yeah. And, you know, and I know some folks in the VR and AR space that are really excited about generative AI from the standpoint of it's not always giving the approaches to this point oftentimes have a real finite environment of which you can explore, right? But if there's constantly a generation engine in the background that's doing, you know, generating new stuff, that's a very interesting prospect. And yeah, I'm very excited about this too. And I think it really does give VR and virtual environments the opportunity to be much more relevant than they are right now.
And when you think about, remember Second Life, how many years ago at ISTE, you know, was Second Life the thing? And ooh, you could go on the ISTE Second Life Island and all of this. Think about crowdsourcing. Think about, or even just like Minecraft, the way that, you know, creators can come together in the same world and build and create. Well, think about what this is going to look like as... What was that? There was a tool that Google had for, I think, for the Quest. I think it was called, I mean, I shouldn't even try to say what it was. It was a painting app, but you were in virtual reality able to paint with it. I'll have to Google it. And, but just unlimited paintbrushes. I mean, even just using Procreate on an iPad, you know, unlimited brushes, unlimited colors, unlimited textures, you know, unlimited layers. What are you going to create? Think about being able to paint with your words, because that's what we can do with a prompt right now, is we can code with our voice and our imagination, and we can describe things precisely, and we can give models and examples. But then think about that in a crowdsourced environment where, you know, maybe we're Lord of the Rings geeks and we want to, you know, build Tolkien's world. And so we can load maps and we can upload the entire Lord of the Rings trilogy and all of the appendices and everything. And then we can, you know, have it go further. I mean, if you haven't been interacting with these AI language models, you may not realize how we as human beings have in some ways already been surpassed, you know, because I am not going to be ingesting the whole web. I am not going to be, you know, generating, you know, these lists of whatever you want to ask for, you know, in 10 seconds. Does it have full sentience? No. Does it have ethics? No. There's a lot of shortcomings. Am I ready to call it an entity deserving of equal rights to a human being? No, but I absolutely have experienced this where it's just like, oh my gosh, this is an intelligence that is beyond what I could do or what I think other human beings can do. And so when we strap this to a virtual headset and this becomes very unbounded, I mean, it's just going to be so tough for these companies to figure out how to do this without having the heck suit, you know, their pants suit off. And because people are going to do all kinds of things with them. And some of those things are going to be illegal, and it's going to be very difficult to try to, you know, corral all of that behavior. But on the good side, it's going to be phenomenal. So do you have to sign up for the Apple promo, or are they doing those at the Apple Store yet? Do you know? I mean,
it's at the Apple Store. So, and part of it is they want to do a little advertising thing for you, so that I'm assuming that they're convinced, probably correctly, that you people are going to want to try this out before they buy it. And also, I believe that, If I understand correctly, you actually have to go in for a fitting to buy one too, because they help it figure out where it fits on your head and such. I've heard a lot of things that are concerning about these early platforms, not the least of which is that it doesn't seem to be a good sharing platform, that it's really set up to be for one person, the battery life isn't super great, it hurts if it's on your head too long, blah, 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 blah. That's a reality that will get dealt with. And my guess is that, well, actually I know for sure, because I knew someone with them, the early MacBooks in the mid 90s were kind of clunkers, as it turns out. They had, 90 minute battery life and, you know, weighed 14 pounds.
And the Mac Air, I mean, it had so little RAM and it was just way, way underpowered. I know somebody who bought the first generation, and that's just, generally, I just don't think that's a great plan. So, okay. So, why don't we talk a little bit about social media?
Sure.
I did not realize that this, first let's do some negative Twitter news, and then let's talk about the search in general. a week ago on Valentine's Day, Ars Technica reported that, Twitter, which it was referring to as Musk's X, sold check marks to Hezbollah and other terrorist groups. So, we've talked about this before, but just being able to, you know, charge anyone who wants to, apparently those that are, you know, prohibited by, U.S. sanction from, you know, engaging in any kind of economic activity, charge $1,000 a month for verified organizations. And so Twitter was happy to take that money. And so, anyway, some of those accounts, I guess, have since been deleted, but anyway, if you're still on Twitter, folks, what are you doing? Get off the platform. no strong opinions or bias there. I'm not sure where I heard about this one. This was probably in a podcast about social media, but this is from the U.S. Department of Human Services. And this was in May of last year, May of 2023. New Surgeon General Advisory raises the alarm about the devastating impact of the epidemic of loneliness and isolation in the United States. And so the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, said, given the significant health consequences of loneliness and isolation, we must prioritize building social connections the same way we've prioritized other public health issues, such as tobacco, obesity, and substance use disorders. Together, we can build a country that's healthier, more resilient, less lonely, and more connected. And so, you know, in terms of social media, and social media, I believe, certainly can have a positive role. I am not here to demonize all social media. Goodness gracious, I'm on a ridiculous number of platforms and I'm, you know, oversharing on a daily basis. But I think that the need that we have for community and the recognition for how technologies can be isolating and not helpful when it comes to loneliness and building community, I've had a chance to reflect with some others. There's some older adults that are in our Sunday school class who've been recently married. And so we were talking about dating apps and just what a minefield that is, you know? Anyway, this is, we talk about social media in the context of, you know, harming students' perception, you know, teenage girls, especially, you know, self-perceptions and leading to teen suicide and that kind of thing. But this Surgeon General advisory about loneliness and isolation and a call for community. I mean, that's, we need schools, right? We need schools where students are connected, where families and parents are connected, where teachers are connected. We all need to build community. And so anyway, that is sort of tangentially related to social media, but I think we need to pay attention to these kinds of pronouncements by our public health leaders because, you know, they're smart folks and I don't think they're using their platforms, you know, for just self-benefit here. I think they're trying to make our nation, our world, you know, healthier and better. So that was something that I had just not seen before.
Yeah, really interesting stuff. And then I'm going to catch this last article on this list. It wasn't that widely reported. I didn't see it in my main news feeds and ran into it under a tech news feed, but apparently, according to the Washington Post on February 15th, there is a piece of tech regulation that could pass the Senate. It has at least 60 votes that could pass the Senate. And it is aimed at kids. And, of course, my short link is not working at all.
That archive link works, though. The archive got today.
There we go. Well, no, I'm getting a welcome to NGIXA page. Well, the point is that I want to make about this is that it's aimed at kids. And one of the things that I think is troubling about this is that that's really, it seems like the only regulation we can agree on, is that we should be regulating it more for kids. And I want to be very careful how I say this, but I don't think that that solves the problem, but more importantly, unless we get broader influence by regulation of these technologies, I feel like that just puts more pressure on schools to try to perform, you know, with technology and helping kids make their way through, but then don't give them any tools to deal with it because everything is so locked down. And don't get me wrong, I'm encouraged by the renaissance that seems to be happening with digital equity and privacy, and all of these pieces are really important, I think, to the bigger picture. But by picking the lowest hanging fruit, which is that we can all agree that we should be, you know, preventing the kids from accessing all these dangerous things, I just don't think that makes the kind of change that we need and that we're looking for. So I am encouraged to find out that it's there. In fact, I talked to a journalist earlier today who asked me if I thought that there should be action here on AI in regards to regulation. I said, I think there should be, but I don't think there will be because the United States struggles, you know, even if we can pass comprehensive social media regulation, social media has been around for 20 years now, right? Facebook is a 20-year-old product. And say what you want about Facebook or any of these tools, X, Instagram, Blue Sky, it doesn't really matter. But the bottom line is that it took us 20 years to get to that point. And some of those hearings to get to that point were extremely, extremely dramatic, right? And so again, I'm interested in the conversation. I don't know enough about the law yet to know if this is going to do anything. I hope it does encourage parents to be more proactive about preventing their children, giving them more tools to help their children. But I do think that the kid only approach is maybe a start to the conversation, but I hope it's not the end of it.
So I just dropped in a link to an EFF article, which was from the end of last year, but we're talking about the Kids Online Safety Act. And this was from EFF, and the headline is Kids Online Safety Shouldn't Require Massive Online Censorship and Surveillance. And some of the criticism I've read about this act is that, number one, it may be unconstitutional, and number two, it may be giving such latitude to individual states to really have some draconian censorship power. It's going to look like, you know, we're communist China or whatever, you know, political system you want to call China. It doesn't look like a free and open society. So yes, I agree with you. Oftentimes when people wave the banner, let's save the children, you know, watch out, because they may just be doing that for political reasons. And there could be, you know, other agendas at play as well. Of course, let's protect the children, but let's also follow the Constitution. And let's recognize that, you know, in the name of regulating tech, it's certainly possible to do a lot of harm as well. One of the areas I think that we definitely need some regulation soon. We need privacy regulation. We need privacy rights here in the United States. And like I mentioned earlier with the Taylor Swift, deepfake videos, in a lot of places, they're really struggling to figure out how to treat that, legally. And so having the right to your image and having some laws that prohibit people from creating harmful, malicious representations of people in deepfake photos or videos, I think that is a specific thing. And then also, I guess the acronym is CSAM, but it's really horrible sexual yeah. abuse content. And there are some very good collaborations that, you know, you name the big tech company, Microsoft, Facebook, Apple, all of these big platforms are doing. But AI, you know, is going to potentially make that whole arena even more difficult to police and to protect. And so I think yeah. there are important reasons to protect children. Unfortunately, the Kids Online Safety Act, while possibly well-intentioned, has some really, really terrible aspects to it. So in this case, I think it's fortunate that, you know, we don't have two bodies in Washington and the legislature that are ready to just, you know, run that through right away. And EFF continues to be, I think, one of our best resources to take a look at when it comes to the potential harms or benefits of tech regulation, as well as a lot of other topics touching on the digital issues of our show. And so I simply Googled, Kids Online Safety Act, EFF, and that article, as well as some others, came right up. Here's a positive one. You want to do a positive one?
Let's do it.
Okay. So this is from yesterday on Ars Technica, February 20th. The headline is, I put this under security and privacy, after years of losing, it's finally the Fed's turn to troll a ransomware group. So what happened, and there's a bunch of screenshots for this, the federal government, in collaboration with a lot of folks, so they'll be referred to as the authorities, from the United States, the UK, and other parts of Europe, have taken down an infrastructure belonging to a company called Lockbit, quote, a ransomware syndicate that has extorted more than $120 million from thousands of victims around the world. But, you know, this particular group and other ransomware groups have been kind of famous for, you know, hacking your system, having a clock with a bomb, you know, and these other things. And they also would try to embarrass by publishing, you know, the names of their victims and who they have hacked. And so there are several different screenshots on this article. And if you are a Linux geek and know about, some of the intricacies of what constitutes a, you know, root level access to a Linux server, they kind of had fun basically pointing out that they completely took control and shut down this entire group and organization. And so Brian Krebs, who's one of the security researchers that we talk about a lot and I think respect quite a bit, quoted in the closing paragraph of the article, in January 2024, Lockbit SUP told XSS S forum members. He was disappointed the FBI hadn't offered a reward for his doxing and or arrest, and in response, he was placing a bounty on his own head, offering $10 million to anyone who could discover his real name. And then he complained, there's not even a reward out for me on the FBI website. Well, maybe that is not the kind of thing you should be taunting the FBI with, because the white hat hackers that have taken control of that have had a little bit of fun. So we don't oftentimes have a positive security article like that. So yay, thank you, FBI and other authorities, I'm sure working for various numbered agencies, both here and abroad, for shutting down this one troll ransomware group. Unfortunately, there's probably 1,000 others that need to be shut down as well. But
well, and this is kind of a random comment, but you know, if you are younger, you know, you're a student in school or maybe in your 20s and are working in the computer industry and you want to go into more cybersecurity stuff and you want to hack, there are extraordinary opportunities with the United States government to do that. My understanding is that they have an extraordinary infrastructure across many different agencies that are, you know, it would be considered white hat hacking, right? Because you're protecting the good guys here. But I think that's a really extraordinary a story. And also, you know, if that's your thing and, you know, you don't want to cause havoc, you want to fight those causing havoc, what incredible career to take on at this particular inflection point.
And we really do need to share that. I'm not going to do this, but I've just been considering, you know, different economic diversification options as a teacher. I did look. I mean, NC State, I think, is and local groups have a pretty good cybersecurity program that in a year or two you can get a credential. And back when I was tech director in Oklahoma City, we had a program at Rose State, which was one of our local community colleges, you know, and their standard pitch was talking about starting salaries at like 70,000. And that's without a college degree. That's with a certificate, in cybersecurity and white hat hacking. So definitely something to let young people know about. Hack for good.
Yep, absolutely.
Let's see. Well, we're coming up to the top of the hour, but we've got a little bit more time. Any other articles catch your eye that you would like to have us address tonight, Dr. Neifer?
Yeah, just something that I shared that I forgot to put a link in here for, but last week, Montana Digital Academy, which is the organization I work for, released a comprehensive framework for schools to get involved in discussions around AI. And it wasn't our document to start with. It was actually initially written by our very good friends at the Michigan Virtual School, which is our siblings in the state of Michigan. And earlier in 2023, they pulled together some resources to come up with a really excellent comprehensive discussion framework about how to be thoughtful in the creation of policies and classroom guidance in regards to AI. And it's a really wonderful document. Through our connections at the Virtual Learning Leadership Alliance, we were able to take this document and release it in Montana with a couple of updates. But if you're in a district that is thinking about policies or really is having core discussions about where to go next with AI and maybe how to embrace it thoughtfully and not hastily. This is a really wonderful document for doing so. It's about 50 pages, but I will say it's a relatively quick read. But if you want to know how to have these discussions, then I think this document is a truly wonderful, a strategy to do exactly this.
Fantastic. Well, sir, do you have a Geek of the Week for us this week?
I do have actually a YouTube channel to share. There is, so I'm like, you know, what I'm sure is everyone else, even the geekiest among us, that I struggle with keeping up with everything that's going on in the AI world. I do listen religiously every week to Hard Fork from the New York Times. And in fact, I'm guessing, Dr. Fryer, that's what led to your text message last week about Perplexity AI. By the way, I did resubscribe over the weekend and I'm kind of having a bit of a love affair with Perplexity AI right now because its source-based research is really, really, really well done. And for some projects I've been working on in regards to AI content development, it's pretty extraordinary. But what this channel is, it's Matt Wolf is the name of the channel. He's got about 500,000 subscribers. So this is not a, this is not a flame out channel, but about every week or so, he does about a 30-minute show about, you know, the headlines in AI. And because I had literally no time last week, to sit down and kind of keep up with the headlines, being in Seattle for NCCE, it caught me up really quickly and really well done. He also has a lot of great tutorials. In fact, I watched his Perplexity tutorial. That's really good. So if you're looking for a quick way to update yourself on headlines and the evolution of these products, then I do strongly believe that Matt Wolf's channel will be worth your time.
Fantastic. All right. Well, at the risk of oversharing, here we go. Podcast from publicinfrastructure.org. This is UMass Amherst, this is Ethan Zuckerman. I don't know if you've followed him for a long time. He was one of the early, you know, web guys and university people. He's just incredible. And so this podcast episode from January 18th, 2024 is called Rewind, Third Wave Internet with Ben Tarnoff. But it is a fantastic discussion about the Fediverse and about the ways in which a number of people are taking a standards-based approach to re-architecting the social media landscape and will perhaps and are giving us, not only through Mastodon, but through other identity-based, standards-based tools, a social web, the possibilities of having this interactive web that's not just going to be controlled by Meta or, Musk or whatever, by just individuals. So really highly recommend that. This is a website from, I think, last week's media literacy discussion. It's called Grandparents of Media Literacy. Let me just say that if you don't have a media literacy program in your school, it's time to establish one. Okay, it's actually past time to establish one, because media literacy, it is literacy, and it's essential that we recognize literacy has changed, and we've got to equip students with skills for the landscape that we live in, that many of us are drowning in. But this is a website that has a lot of thought leaders and authors and, you know, folks that we should know as educators when it comes to media literacy. And I just thought that was fantastic. I rebooted my after page. And so if you go to westfriar.com/after, I made this a little more graphical. WordPress has got some, you know, social links, and I have a ridiculous number of social media channels. One of the things that you can link to on that is a new webinars channel. I'll be doing a free webinar tomorrow night called Cooking with AI and ChatGPT. And so if anybody wants to check that out, you are certainly invited to do so. And I've already shared then my link to connect with me later. Where should folks find you, Dr. Neifer, when you're not here on StreamYard on the EdTech Situation Room?
I need to finish up making the website useful. AIcentrist.com is where you can find me, and then I'll have links on there at some point to my active social media channel. It's probably the best is LinkedIn for me.
Awesome. Sounds good. Well, we want to thank everybody for tuning in. We are usually here on Wednesday evenings, but sometimes other things happen. And so if you want to stay in touch with that, the best option is to follow us on social media. Oddly enough, Jason, you'll have to test this, because our Mastodon account I could post to, but I couldn't see it from my own instance on Mastodon.cloud. So I don't know what's going on with that. But our Facebook page is up and active, and hopefully our Mastodon page is, you know, still available as well. So we thank you all for tuning in and encourage you to stay savvy, stay safe, and please join us again live or whenever you have an opportunity on the EdTech Situation Room. EdTechSR.com is where you can get all of those links. Have a great week.
Good night.